Well, good evening, everybody. I forgot to put the intro on, so I'm going to put it on right now.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or send in your question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org.
Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. here along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. How are you both doctors doing this evening?
Very well.
Very well. How's it going, Nate?
It's going fantastic. Today is episode 199. It's a pretty exciting time that we made it through 199 episodes. And next week, we are going to be doing our 200th episode with a little special announcement. Mm. So it's pretty exciting.
Very good.
And so I'm just grateful to you, Dr. Lyle, for sticking it out with me for these 4 years, and grateful to you, Dr. Hawk, for joining us these last few months. So it's been a lot of fun, and it's been great. Listeners love it. You know, everybody loves it.
All grand.
Yeah, well, that's a total pleasure. A lot of episodes. Yeah, that's great.
It's been a lot of fun.
All right,
and
let's get
today,
on with it. Enough of the fuzzy stuff.
No small talk today, apparently.
No sentimental. All right.
It was a good effort, Nate.
Yeah, I'm kind of bad at these sentimental things, but you know, we'll do it the slow, fast way next time. All right.
There you go.
All right, so we've got a few questions today, a couple of short ones, a couple of more in-depth ones. So we're going to just take it from the top. Now, the title of the show today is the first topic is called Bluffing Conscientiousness, but that was because the very first question didn't have to do with conscientiousness. That's the second question. So our first question had to do with being in the same tier attractiveness, attraction-wise. So I just really didn't know how to title it. So here we go. Let's just take it. Dear doctors,
sure.
If two people typically rate as 10 out of 10, but one is deemed more attractive on average, would that mean that they are objectively better looking while being in the same tier?
I think I'll take this just because I've actually had quite a bit of feedback in the last couple, 3 years on this show about like, how critical I am about females' looks and how I'm always rating them. I mean, I can't.
Women,
it.
It's women, it's, Doug, not females.
Sorry about that. Sorry, I'll try to slip that in. I'll never actually get that right. The which of course I find rather
said.
Amusing because the truth is this is a universal phenomenon. It's not a Doug Lyle thing, for goodness sakes. It's also true. I've also heard it often said that, oh, that rating thing that men use, it's like, holy smokes. This is a universal phenomenon, not just among humans. This is in the animal kingdom. Okay. So, all right. So what are we talking about here? When we assign numbers, if you're more literary, so I don't know that Jen ever uses numbers, but Jen has this massive vocabulary. No, no.
I think I'm offended.
Oh, don't be offended.
We might not use numbers to
describe people's
attractiveness. We're very descriptive, obviously. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all about.
Yeah. It's not as if women
vocabulary.
Aren't. Sure. Yeah.
Right.
It's not as if women are not assessing, you know, the relative attractiveness of different males. They're just maybe not doing it in such a strict 0 to 10 system on such regular basis. At least not the women I have traditionally hung out with.
Yeah. So in any event, The notion here is that if you use a 1 to 10 scale, this is just a convenient way to demark deciles on this. So if you're a 5, then you're at the 50th percentile. If you're a 7, you're at the 70th percentile. And so if you're a 9, you're at the 90th percentile. And for those of you that it's been a while since you took stats, 90th percentile means that 90% of the distribution is below you and 10% is above you effectively. So if you're a 10 in principle, then out of a straw poll of 100 people of your gender and age, you would be the most attractive out of 100, and 99 would be less attractive than you, objectively rated by some numbers of raters. So the so if two people are rated as 10s, obviously we can see that when we use descriptors like 8s, 9s, and 10s, it's necessarily sloppy, because what would you call someone that you would think is a 7.5 or a 7.7? You're not going to say 7.7. Now, I might, but most people wouldn't, okay? And most people, when they're even using these numbers, they're not even using them as consciously as deciles. They're just sort of generally descriptive of what it is. But when I'm using them, I'm plotting them directly on a bell curve and demarking deciles according to my subjective estimation of some individual. So therefore, a pair of people that I might rate as 10s, I still might, I'm going to rate somebody who I think is a 9.7 as a 10. Okay, well, you're not going to rate them a 9. So unless you're going to go to the trouble and say, well, I think that's a 9.7, and it gets ridiculous. So you just say, hey, it's a 10. You're effectively in a straw poll of 10 people. They are probably the most attractive of the 10. However, what's interesting is if you have two people that are extremely attractive and that you would say, hey, in any straw poll, they're the most attractive person of the group, then the two of them together, of course, wouldn't surprise anybody. You'd say, okay, well, it's a pair of 10s. And however, one of them, you could notice that one of them appears to be a 99th percentile and the other one might appear to be a 96th percentile. So you might pick up some characteristics that you believe objectively delineating, you know, or indicating a difference between those two to the level of 3 percentile. And so that's why, you know, when we say same tier, there is no such thing as a tier. A tier is whatever you want to make it. You want to make a tier 5 percentile tiers, you want to make them 20 percentile tiers. There isn't any tiers. Okay. That's just sort of a sloppy way, but possibly useful descriptively to talk about a general group that you might think might be, you know, some imaginary line where there'd be a group of people that would be objectively close enough in their attractiveness that they would be possibly somewhat interchangeable within the group in terms of their how attractive anybody finds them within the group. So that would be indicate that the correlation coefficients within a tier start to fall towards zero. So let me explain further what this is going to mean. If you had a group of 10 people that was truly randomly distributed out of the population, if it was truly random, it's very likely that the distribution would look something like this. There would be somebody that would be at about the 10th percentile for attractiveness, somebody else at about the 20th, somebody else at about the 30th, somebody else about the 40th, then 50, 60, all the way up to 10. Okay. And so you would notice that the people that are 4 to 6 were pretty similar. And it would be a little bit hard to get agreements about who was the 5 and who is the 4. However, the agreement would be extremely high between a question of who's the 8 and who's the 5. In other words, all judges would agree about which one is the 8 and one is the 5, and all judges would agree about who is the 4 and who is the 1. Okay, so the correlation coefficient between any two raters, if we're rating people along deciles, is almost perfect. In other words, there's basically no agreement or almost no disagreement between any two raters. This has been demonstrated around the globe. Doesn't matter where you pull the pictures from what culture. If you have me and Nathan judging women from, you know, Bantu Africa or whatever, we would judge them exactly the same way as the people within the culture would judge them. In other words, our agreement would be essentially identical with any judge on earth. However, if you get within a decile, let's suppose that we instead very carefully grab a bunch of people that are between 7 and 8. So we have 1,000 raters rate 1,000 people, and we take the 700th, you know, most attractive to the 800th most attractive. So we take the 7s to the 8s. Now within there, the correlation coefficients are going to get muddy. So if we were to take people, the person who is, for example, 70th percentile, then 71st, then 72nd, 73rd, 74th, 75th out of 1,000 people. So we're talking at that number 700, 710, 720, 730, et cetera, up to 800. And we made those our 10 people. So then we took those to Africa or to Kansas or to Canada or to Europe, and we had any set of judges look at these. It's going to turn out that the correlation coefficients would be not nearly as high. They wouldn't be 0.94. It's going to get sloppy. And the reason is that the human eye isn't going to be in that great of agreement as to who is a 72nd percentile versus who's a 76th percentile. It's getting kind of dicey. Okay. Now, the truth is that you're going to see, obviously, that the correlations are going to get stronger if we took like two people, we took a group of four and we said, okay, well, we got one of them that's the 71st and one of them that's the 72nd. And then we've got one of them that's the 79th and one of them that's the 80th percentile. And we're going to put those four pictures in the middle of the pot, and we're going to have thousands of pairs of raters rate those. What would we expect the correlation coefficients to be? And the answer is pretty high, but not nearly as high as 0.94. It's probably 0.6. Okay. So there starts to be some disagreement among the raters. So this is, however, the correlation coefficient is positive. In other words, it's not zero. So it doesn't suddenly get subjective as to who's the 7 and who's the 8. It's still a great deal of objectivity, even at that level. It's just that the degree of objectivity is now slipping, and we're seeing more subjectivity in the data, okay? If we were to continue to do this and try to find a distinction, we take 10,000 people, and we take the 71st percentile and the 72nd percentile, and then we have 71.1, 71.2, all the way through 71.9, and then 72.0. Those differences, the correlation would approach zero. In other words, there would be the two raters would have almost would have huge disagreements as to is the 71.1 more attractive than the 71.2, or is the 71.2 reliably more attractive than the 71.1? And the answer would be it gets really sloppy. Okay, so at some point, the human eye cannot delineate. And cannot pick up objective differences. But when this question, what people are saying is, what if it's a pair of tens? What does that mean? What does it mean that one of them is fancier than the other? And it's fairly objective. In other words, it's pretty common that that's what the reaction is. The answer is that the human eye is actually able to reliably pick up differences between individuals, even at the level of a few percentile points. Now, it's going to turn out that that's going to be most reliable at the very top of the curve. It's not going to be reliable at the bottom of the curve, and it's not going to be reliable in the middle of the curve. So the objectivity of the difference between a 50th percentile and a 55th percentile is going to be incredibly difficult to demonstrate. There's going to be some objectivity, but it's going to be pretty weak. But the difference between a 95th percentile and a 99.9 is very clear. Okay, so that's because the human eye, as a person's attractiveness converges on perfection, the beauty detection mechanisms are beautifully designed to actually pick up even the slightest imperfections and to essentially run a score on what it thinks of those genetic mutations. So that's why this person has observed what they've observed. So we can look at two people, they're a pair of tens. But most people say, hey, she's actually more attractive than he is, even though they're both super attractive. And the majority of people would agree if she's a 97 and he's a 94. Okay. So that's what we're picking up, a fascinating observation that there's two factors here. One of them is objectivity and the other is subjectivity. So the question is, at what point does the subjectivity start to intrude and make a major factor in the analytics? The answer is almost none at the level of deciles. In other words, the decile levels are almost perfect correlation coefficients. However, as we start to move our way into within a decile, it starts to grow. The subjectivity starts to get greater, but it is very clearly still demonstrable, okay? As we start getting down to the level of he's a 9.7 and she's a 9.6, then there's no agreement in the room. Half the people think she's prettier than he is. Half the people think he's handsomer than she is. And there is no correlation coefficient because they're too close, okay? But in the observation where you have seen in your life, if you've seen people that where there seems to be a reliable opinion of difference, you're picking up on objective differences in attractiveness at the level of a few percentile points, which are almost always only able to be detected at the very highest level of the distribution.
That's fascinating. Now, Dr. Hawk, can we get your take on this?
It's a lot of fancy math for some toxic masculinity is what that
is. See, here's the thing. I still don't understand why. I mean, mostly I get when I talk about this with females or women or, you know, girls, mm-hmm. ladies seem to have most of the problems with this type of system. And of course it's objective. And so therefore they feel like they are being objectified. But for me, like I look at these numbers and it's actually relaxing to think that there's actually mathematical certainty. Well, not certainty, but you know what I mean? There's mathematics behind this, and that you know, we're not saying that the person's a better individual or more useful coalition member. It's just about gene mutations, right?
I think a lot of the reason that women struggle with this so much is that this is not something that comes naturally to most women. They're not drawn to it in this particular very strict decile oriented way that Doug is talking about. And they also are not, they don't grow up practicing this in this kind of way. So this is not a common experience to the American woman, not in my experience, that you're going around rating men on a scale of 1 to 10. It doesn't happen that way. And I think also that women are so familiar directly and immediately with the repeat exposure effect that they have watched their attraction to different men change over time as they've gotten to know different men, that it's all much more fluid from their perspective, and men can sort of rise and fall in their eyes in reference to their personality characteristics and the quality of their company. So it's a much less strong intuition and tendency in women. And so I think when they see men do it, they feel that it's really particularly strict and objectifying and not a natural process. So that's why it's often interpreted as being socially constructed, or you got this from the culture, you know, toxic media or the patriarchy, et cetera, et cetera.
That is absolutely fascinating. That is really great, Jen. I never even considered that. And that's, I've always been a little irritated at the fact that I would get any pushback or irritation from women about this. Mm. And of course I'm like, well, sorry. Life's competitive, and it's just as competitive for us as it is for you. And don't tell me that females aren't doing incredibly defined, essentially assessment of male attractiveness, because they obviously and clearly are, not just in our species, but in all species. So what do we think sexually selected characteristics are? Okay. Mm-hmm. So in other words, I've always been quietly simmering over the fact that I was supposed to swallow this as a politically incorrect, you know, faux pas, and knowing full well that there was no reason to hide from, hey, bell curves and numbers. But this is really interesting. So Yeah. So because you're right, the subjective experience of women is different than the subjective experience of men on this dimension. And it's causing mm-hmm. them to be, you know, maybe frustrated, confused, feel like, hey, wait a minute, isn't it supposed to be fluid? Can't I win some points mm-hmm. with my inner beauty?
You know what I mean? Inner beauty count? So, your inner beauty counts for so much. So why doesn't mine? So it's very, it makes no sense with that egocentric bias. Yeah.
Right. Fantastic. Got it.
So, so if we add in the number system, but then we add in a third dimension of time spent getting to know the person, then it becomes more applicable to women.
Maybe, but repeat exposure is not linear, so you can get in trouble with repeat exposure just as easily as you can improve your odds.
Yes.
So this, you qualify today, you don't qualify tomorrow. Like you know, you mispronounce, you know, you say library instead of library, and you're out. So you never know. But
how do you trust your own instincts then? You never know.
The only thing you can trust. I had a friend once, as we were having this conversation, like, well, how do you know when you just intuitively know that you're it's not going to work? And she's like, well, you know that feeling that you have when it feels like your insides want to get up and run away out of your body? Like when he says something that disqualifies him, or he says something that's just, it's just shuts down. Like it's just immediate, that disqualification can happen. And it's not because of outer beauty. It's because of personality. It's because of characters and all of these character qualities and all of these things that we would link to his provisional capacity, basically.
Yes. Hmm. Outstanding. Great.
Wow.
All right.
Well, that makes a little more sense because I've been on the other end of that. All right. So we actually had a caller call in during that question, so I figure we'll just take them right now, and then we can take the rest of the questions. All right.
Okay.
So,
sure.
This caller told me his name is Jimmy, the guitar player from Canada. So, Jimmy, the guitar player, welcome to the show.
Oh, perfect, Jimmy. Long time no see.
Hi, everyone. I think Jen wants to talk to him.
I definitely want to talk to Jimmy.
All right, Jimmy.
What's going
let
on?
Let it roll.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. Long time listener. Love the show.
Hold on. That just sounds like Jimmy. Just he's swaggering into the con. He's already swaggering in.
Hey, Doug, hush.
All right.
Let the man talk.
Go ahead.
So I have a question about marriage. And Dr. Lyle, you've spoken about how marriage doesn't necessarily fit the way that pair bonding would have worked in the Stone Age environment.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, in this day and age, if two people do decide to wed, are there any safeguards that either of you would recommend to put in place for ensuring the best outcome? So for instance, you've mentioned in order to stop eating junk food, you don't keep any in the house. Is there an equivalent of that for marriage? Because my girlfriend's not really particularly fond of the wife chippy strategy.
Well, she shouldn't be marrying Jimmy the guitar player.
Yeah. All right, Jen, why don't you take a pass at that? And while I think, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that there's no universal answer to that question at all, that it has everything to do with your personalities and sort of what your tolerance thresholds are for I would immediately sort of think of the chippy question and open marriages and polyamory and all of these things, which are kind of some type of safeguard. I put that in big quotes for certain kinds of marriages for the right kinds of personalities. So, one of the other really well-known evolutionary psychologists in this field is Jeffrey Miller at the University of New Mexico. And he just married his long-term girlfriend. And they are very openly polyamorous. And it's a big part of what makes their relationship successful. And they have a lot to say on that. So that they're an interesting resource for that particular question. But obviously, that's not a solution that works for everybody. It doesn't work for every personality. So I think the best thing that I would give to this, if there's not anything structural that you can do in that sort of sense, is to just make the best use of all of the different little clinical practices that we have, just to make sure that you're you know, I again put this in really big quotes because this is a terrible phrase, but, you know, good communication, i.e. you're practicing something approximating what we call crystal clear when you run into conflict. So you're not letting things turn into bad feedback loops, essentially. So that's the main thing that you want to be watching for, especially around issues of jealousy or perceived cheating or perceived chippies or anything like that. So just keeping that sort of a quasi-institutionalized practice in the relationship to just raise those issues as they come up and crystal clear the hell out of them and just make sure that you're really on the same page about that all the time. That would be the main kind of general piece of advice that I would have, not knowing anything about what kind of personalities we're dealing with and what sort of tolerance level you would have for different structural changes to the relationship and what those might look like.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Still there? Did I lose everyone?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I would add one more thing that I can think of. And this is a this is a little brutal, but it's worth thinking through. And that is that I suggest to women that even though this is this may cross go straight across your life plan and what it feels like that you would like to do and what you think would optimize your existence. But I would suggest that you make sure that you become skilled and educated enough that you can support yourself.
That's very important. So you're never in a position of weakness.
Yeah. You don't want to live your life in a position of weakness. And you also want to be in a situation not only that you don't want to be in a position of weakness. You don't want to be a burden on the other side of this where someone wants to leave you, but they can't afford to because they can't afford to support you and themselves in a new relationship. And so what I'm really getting at is a grisly truth that we're going to look down the barrel of this thing and we're going to be courageous about this, which is the one of the best things that you can do for your life in general and for any relationship is to essentially get out if it's lousy. Okay. So the notion is here isn't that the idea here is, listen, you know, you don't want to waste your opportunity to have an outstanding life experience, and you don't want to waste your partner's either. And so the notion is that you don't want to be in a situation where you're doing somebody a favor and you're choking on your own desires for freedom, because we either can't afford it financially or we feel like they can't afford it emotionally. So the notion, I would recommend that anybody contemplating getting married reads How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World by Harry Brown. And that is a manifesto of human freedom, including within relationships and the general principles by which to approach all relationships and life in general. And behind that, ironically, Harry comes down very negatively on marriage. Okay. And then, of course, what's quite ironic is he gets married twice after he writes that book. Okay.
Hey, Brad.
So
love is a hell of a drug.
My attitude is, of course, there's nothing in the world wrong in principle with getting married, and I'm not anti-marriage at all. What I am, and what I want to warn people is this is a 50-year decision you're making with a 5-year chip, and so you can be making a wise, intelligent, and mature choice. And in the modern world, it can involve basically total integration of both finances as well as child raising, et cetera. And in doing so, it's putting barriers to exit and an interdependence on these two people that it never had in the Stone Age. So the barriers to exit are astronomically high. They are nothing like they were in the nature of the animal. And so as a result, because those barriers are so high, you have a lot of people choking down year after year of their lives, frustrated and miserable. Okay. Now we see how how true this is. I mean, I'm always just amazed at the sort of right-wing conservative lamenting of the breakdown of the family. It's like, are you people out of your minds? This should be celebrated. This is absolute evidence of the greater economic power of women, the less dependency of children and their welfare on a man and his provisioning capacities, and basically freeing people from each other so that they can say, hey, we're, and it isn't, quote, a mistake because you're getting a divorce. That doesn't mean your marriage was a mistake. It means it ran its course. It had its 5-year run that it was designed to have, or it was a mistake that we found out later that we weren't well suited to each other. So what? Okay. Why is it that when this happens, when you're 22, it's a breakup of a boyfriend and girlfriend, but those two same people at 24 years old, when they get married and 2 years later, they want to break up. Oh, it's a divorce. Oh my God, we got to talk to the deacon. And we're going to have the in-laws involved, and this is a big freaking crisis. Why? Okay, that's because people are gutless, and they aren't thinking through any of these things that we're talking about. So,
well, and also, quickly interrupt, I think a lot of that is also the won't someone please think of the children, and this idea that children, once you've had kids, this is a lot of what the religious right and the breakdown in the family is about, that basically the taken at face value notion that children are going to be completely destroyed for life by a divorce and by single parentdom. I hear some like really smart people on the right talking about this. I was just hearing, listening to Heather McDonald talk about it the other day, where she's putting it forth as if this is as, you know, solid evidence that children are going to grow up to be super compromised if they grow up in a single parent home, and there's just no evidence for that. So that's what a lot of that is. Go back to the general point, but I think that's a big thing to also keep in mind when you're deciding to bind your life up with somebody else, that don't let your personality keep you in it. Don't let financial dependence keep you in it, and don't let the kids keep you in it.
Right. God, thank goodness Jen's here with us to remind me of these things, because I don't think of that. I don't even consider it. But of course, that's a huge consideration that I talk to people about often, because they're contemplating this and they're worried about the impact on the children. And of course, my immediate reaction is, don't even think about that. It's
no impact on
the children at all. Okay. Of course, just like any short-term adjustment that's scary, children could be wailing and very upset, but this is absolutely short-term and there's no impact at all, ever has been demonstrated in any scientific literature. It's exceedingly clear that there is no problem. Okay. So incidentally, the research that any of the right cites is all correlational research, which is a huge mistake. You cannot do the research that way. Okay, so it's all wrong. So no, the evidence is very clear from anybody that's looking at the research right side up, that there's no long term impact on any known dimension from that process. So there you go. So my thing is, maybe like it's talking about a psychotherapist with 30 years experience. Okay. What am I thinking? I'm thinking, careful about the exit. Okay. Mm-hmm. Careful about be thinking about, you know, that we're not going to go in blind here and assuming that if we have a good attitude and say positive thoughts and affirmations every day, that we're going to just manage to avoid the lurking serious possibility that this relationship has a very different character 10 years from now than it does now. Okay. Mm-hmm. So if we feel like, no, I want to do this, I feel like it's right, I feel like I can, you know, I think there's a good chance that myself and my partner could be among a modest size minority that is really happy very long term. Is it possible? It absolutely is possible. Is it even plausible? Yes. Okay. If you have wise, intelligent, mature choice, and it turns out that, you know, you're not, God help you if you're 22 and doing this, but if you're 34 and doing this, you've seen the world a little bit, you know yourself quite a bit better, and you know life better, and you may be ready to make that choice. However, don't look, don't stick our heads in the sand about the possibility that we may want to go our separate ways at some point. And if we do, if we want to, we want to be able to do so. And so keep that in mind, and keep in mind that really there should, we would hope that there would be nothing that would stop you from leaving if you wanted to leave. That's about the most important thing that I can say about getting married.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. Jimmy, the guitar player from Canada, thank you very, very much for that great question.
I did have a follow-up, Nate, if that's okay.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Sure.
Yep. So in my own experience, from an anecdotal standpoint, the five-year chip seems to have a lot of truth to it. I was just wondering, where did that number come from? Is it derived from studying hunter-gatherer tribes? Is it just an estimation?
A five-year-old is pretty competent. So once you've had a kid and it's about 5 years old, it's going to keep itself mostly alive in a Stone Age village kind of context. So you don't need the support as much as you did. So it's evolutionarily more sound to diversify the gene pool at that point than to continue in your same pair bond.
Yeah.
Got it.
So these incidentally are, these are all sort of estimations, looking at observations of,
yeah,
of people's,
sure,
mating behavior. So Helen Fisher has called, you know, she'll argue that it's 7 years, you know, so whatever, mm-hmm, Helen. So I think everybody likes that because there was the famous phrase,
seven-year itch.
And I came up with 5 years because I like how it's got alliteration with, you're trying to make a 50-year decision with a 5-year chip. Okay, that's the way. So, but the truth of the matter is that it's actually based on precisely what Jen is saying, which is the critical period is pregnancy and a couple, 2 or 3 years afterwards when the child is very young. Super important that it has a heavy paternal investment at that point. And as the child gets 3, 4, 5 years old, the risk is now much less. And as a result, the critical need for the guy being in love with her and she being in love with him winds up being evolutionarily less important.
Mm-hmm. I think the 7-year itch is basically when the 5-year chip, the 5-year chip is when it expires, and it takes another 2 years with personality and all of the sort of all this financial garbage and everything else that we're talking about to actually take action on it.
Yeah, it starts itching at 5 years, but it doesn't get scratched for 2 more years. That's it.
Exactly. Right. Maybe not till year 8.
All right.
Well, Jimmy,
thank you.
Jimmy, thank you.
Terrific.
Very much for the phone call. Really appreciate it. Great question.
Yeah. Thank you for taking my question.
All right. Good night, Jimmy.
You bet.
Yeah. Have a good night.
All right. So, one thing that you said, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, what's that?
Jen's all happy.
Jen's all happy because we had Jimmy, the guitar player, call in. Although he's getting married, so a hell of a lot of good that does me.
Oh, well, but, you know.
Any other Jimmys that want to call in tonight, you know, the phone lines are open.
So one thing, you know, that I'm just thinking about right now as I'm unwinding your answers is, you know, in previous shows, Dr. Lyle, you've said that if you're, you know, trying to date, for example, you know, dating profiles, that you, since mm-hmm. your competition is going to be bluffing or is going to be representing themselves as a little more fancier and a little bit more willing to provide, you know, a little bit better than what they actually are. And so therefore, if you don't do that, you're going to be left behind. Right. In terms of context, is all the, just for males, from my perspective, if all the mm-hmm. males are essentially signaling, and even though they don't know that they have a 5-year chip, but they're signaling that they're willing to marry and provision for the rest of the woman's life. And mm-hmm. then, you know, listeners of this podcast, they're like, well, sorry, I'm willing to provision you for 5 to 7 years, but not forever. where does that leave us?
Believe it or not, I can actually envision a future, you know, 100 years from now where the thought will be that this is a 10-year decision. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I could see where actually there could be, it could become so obvious and the people could become so, you know, so essentially wealthy relative mm-hmm. to basic needs that essentially that it isn't even expected that these two people are going to be having a lifelong thing. It's just that they've decided that they're essentially married and probably exclusive then and want to be exclusive. They're sort of signaling that they want to be exclusive and that they have this great love for each other and that they, that that's it, that they're an official couple and that, you know, that they hope and expect that it might go forever, but they certainly, but the cultural expectation might be quite a bit different 100 years from now than it is now. Right now, there's still, we have some of our roots back in the 1800s still. And so we still have some of our roots in a very poor country where you cannot possibly, you know, it is a tragedy for children to have their father die or become disabled or divorce their mother. And so there's a, so there's a specter over this that hangs very, very heavy and for many reasons. And now that that is now, it, there still is major potential financial issues, but not for everybody. So we see that, that, you know, a lot of people, if you are, if you're have high openness to experience and you have a lot of means, those people are much more likely to get divorced. Incidentally, statistically, mm-hmm. those people are happier. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In other words, the fact that they can get out of relationships that they don't want to be in because everybody has the means to survive it without any big crisis. And they have the openness to say, oh no, I'm not going to waste my existence in something that I'm not happy. I'm leaving. We might infer that, oh God, she's been divorced three times. You know, what a miserable train wreck of a human. When the truth of the matter is, oh no, not at all. The truth is when you actually look at those individuals, if we're not looking at the unstable, low SES that's scrambling around just, you know, in trouble for finances, if instead we look at people that are higher SES and were not being financially irresponsible and that wasn't being chaotic, that these were simply lifestyle decisions and they decide, no, you know, I'm the guy was more Horace and Jimmy and it turns out I'm not that interested now. See you later. Okay. That individual, when we actually study their life satisfaction, those are happier individuals than individuals that don't behave that way. So, mm-hmm. But I can imagine, we can see on a continuum what a change there has been in for the United States and in Europe over the last, you know, 70 years. In 1950, yeah. this was a disaster. In 1970, it was scary, but it's starting to become more common and kind of only the flakes, you know, did this and et cetera. Mm-hmm. By the year 2020, it's like, hey, I guess your relationship didn't work out. That's sad. We'd all like to support and keep it together. You know, we're going to go to the pastor. But the truth of the matter is people are going to do what they're going to do. So that's because it's dawning on people that that. You know, this, it doesn't seem that the children are winding up delinquents everywhere because their friends got a divorce and those kids are fine. Okay. It's starting to dawn on people that this needn't be a disaster. So I don't have to suck it up and choke down 50 years when my chip tells me it's time to move on. So I think that in the future, mm-hmm. Increasing financial independence is going to lead to greater and greater, higher percentages of people having been divorced at least once or twice in their life. And I think that that's why I'm emphasizing, as I did in this question, that one of the most important things that women can do is don't forget to get yourself financially independent, capable. Whether or not you mm-hmm. you exercise that financial capability in your marriage is independent of the fact of whether or not you've got the degrees and skills to be able to go to the marketplace and support yourself and your children quite comfortably if you need to part ways. And that's you want the that kind of independence sitting inside your CV of that relationship for the whole ride.
Mm-hmm. You know, also in terms of updates, recently I've started to see people celebrate, you know, having divorce parties. So they get married, realize it doesn't work out,
sure.
and instead of having a big yeah. drag through family court, they just have a party uh-huh. and say, hey, it just didn't work out.
Yeah. I think this is as you normalize divorce, as Doug's talking about, and then you also just have less draconian institutions, and it's all, you know, people are less tied to really traditional religious beliefs, and families have gotten more liberal over the course of a few generations, and all of these things, that you also have, you know, you have ceremonial marriages but not legal marriages, so those are more fluid, and people, they just kind of have a separation party, and that's that. I have lots of friends who sort of maintain some kind of relationship with their exes, including integrated family arrangements. So I have a friend who goes to the holidays every year with her ex and her family and calls them her outlaws instead of her in-laws. So she hangs out with the outlaws for the holidays. And it's just one big sort of happy clan. And a lot of people are doing this and moving in this direction. And it's a reflection of the inherent diversity in the bell curve of personality and the kinds of tolerance thresholds people have for different sorts of arrangements, both within the primary relationship and extended to the family, and the less oppressive the institutions, the more of that diversity you're going to actually see play out. So although financial independence is as important as it is, it doesn't compensate for the other big problem, which we may not have even time to get into, but that's the agreeableness problem, which we talked about. We actually pre-recorded a show, I think, that's coming out in a few weeks, where I talk about this a lot, that that's the second biggest reason that when I talk to clients that they're staying in bad relationships is that they are talking themselves into it behind their agreeableness, and they don't want to cause a fuss, and they're still seeing the good in their partner, and they don't want to throw it all out, and they are willing to take a bad deal just inherently because of that agreeableness. So they're systematically undervaluing their freedom and their happiness. So that's a bigger problem than just being financially independent, although financial independence is a necessary if not sufficient part of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Lyon, Dr. Hawk, just to appease some of our listeners that may be thinking about this particular point, which is, I've heard and I've seen people throw around in different discussion groups about, single mothers, the kids of single mothers are far more likely to be, criminals and have this problem, that problem, this problem. To that, you say what?
Yes, correlationally.
Well, mm-hmm. Yes.
Not causally.
Right. Yeah, so the reason is that it is statistically likely that single mothers are likely to be lower SES. They're likely to be less educated. They're likely to have less conscientiousness. In other words, now please keep this in mind. This is statistical. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So these are averages.
These are statistical averages. They say those aren't causal forces. The reason why single mothers are having children, for example, they're having more problems in school, is because the guy that they married and that the guy that they slept with and had that kid with, the two of them are inherently less stable humans genetically.
Unstable, low conscientious, and lower IQ most likely.
Right.
Yeah.
So therefore, that's why the child is having problems in school, is because of the child's genes, not because of the fact that the mom is a single mom. So you show me a single mom who graduated from Swarthmore, okay, and the dad is, works for Goldman Sachs. And now we're going to see that she's a single mom and we see her three kids. Let me take a wild guess to what those kids look like. Super high achieving, really smart, no problems. Okay. So we can so you have to control. In other words, once you control for mom's genes and the father's genes, there is no effect at all negative of being a single mother. None. Okay. So this is the inability of commentators to understand this because the whole world doesn't understand that behavior genetics is where it's at.
Fascinating. Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, it's very uncomfortable conversation for those commentators to have. They don't want to talk about behavioral genetics in that way, especially when it's averages across populations. So,
right.
It's very
and they also
third
don't
rail
know
of
it.
American politics.
Oh, yeah.
And they don't
know
it.
This, right. they don't know this, and they're confident that, you know, education and upbringing and, you know, all these kinds of things have this really important mm-hmm. impact on human character development, and it has absolutely
right.
none.
Because okay. everyone has an yeah. anecdote. Everybody knows yeah. somebody who knows somebody who, you know, their kids started acting out after the divorce and they were perfectly well behaved before that. And so it's clearly it's the divorce and it's the fact that dad's not, I mean, like this is, it's the same with the diet world. Everyone's got an anecdote
right.
about Grandma Mabel who ate 4 strips of bacon and 7 mm-hmm. eggs every day and smoked 5 cigarettes with her breakfast and lived to 97. Like it's, this is, you know, anecdotes are not data.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, fantastic. Well, we've got to thank Jimmy the guitar player for starting this whole thing. So this whole discussion. So really appreciate him calling in. I think we're going to wrap it up. We'll take the rest of the questions next week. So next week is
right.
episode 200. So
number 200. Hopefully we don't have any
right.
you know, Y2K problems. Rolling over into a new decade here.
All right. Well, that's
very exciting.
Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, thank you very much for coming on as always, and we'll look forward to talking with you next week.
Fantastic.
Oh, thanks so much, Nate. It's delightful. All right, good night.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.